The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday night. Hope you're having a nice evening. And it is the weekend, and we are moving into the holiday season. Next week is Thanksgiving, and then insane Black Friday, which is going to be probably more crazy than ever, given the economy. Wait and see. That's always a field day for the lower realms of humanity, or whatever we call it. We have on the line our friend and colleague, Harry Cooper, who is on once a month. Harry is in Jacksonville, Florida tonight. He, of course, the founder and proprietor of sharkhunters.net or .com?
.com.
Somebody wrote the other day and asked me if it was .net also. But anyway, it's sharkhunters.com, and I want to make that clear. And Harry is on once a month, and we usually take photo trips. We may go somewhere tonight, but they may not be by photo. What we're going to do, though, is look at some remarkable images done by our splash artist, David Dees, who has worked on some books with Harry Cooper that are going to stun you. Look under Harry's name and guests and pull up those covers. What about these books, Harry, and why the new covers? What they are is extraordinary pieces of history to begin with. But why the new covers? And let me tell you, I have never seen ever better World War II vintage depictions in book covers. They're peerless. They're with David Dees. They're incredible.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Your buddy Dees is one heck of an artist, boy. This guy is incredible.
When did the books first come out?
Oh boy. Well, let's see.
Well, let me rephrase that. The most important thing about the books is that they are full of vignettes and stories and anecdotes by people who lived those days.
That's correct.
That's what makes the books timeless. It doesn't really matter when they came out. What matters is you folks who are interested in World War II history can pick any one of these books up, open it up almost to any page, start reading, and be jerked back in time and just put in the jaws of the most horrific human conflict the planet has ever seen. It is staggering. And somehow David has captured all of that, the timelessness of war, but the strife, the human condition, and in a way, the almost unworldly beauty of some of the scenes of it. I mean, it's dark, it's deadly, But it is stunning, and I'm not. We have David with us. He'll be on in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to ask him about these covers and what kind of motivation came into play. But they are just stunning. The books—they're
beautiful. They sure are.
The books, Harry, are by friends of yours, basically people you've known in many, many cases, and they are as close as you're going to get, folks, to really understanding what happened in World War II. It's that simple.
That's true. Each one of the books, U-Boat Volume 1, Volume 2, 3, 4, 5, and also When Eagles Soared, Volume 1 and 2, there's not a plot line going through the whole book like a normal novel or something. Each chapter is a separate, standalone memory of one of the World War II veterans. U-Boat Volumes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, of course, are by submarine guys and, in some cases, American anti-submarine guys. And the Eagles book, Volume 1 and 2, are by the flyboys, Luftwaffe guys, as well as American, a couple of Brits, and even one called the Walrus, or what the hell is that? That's about a guy who was the forward gunner on a Supermarine Walrus, which was a flying boat that...
Never heard of it.
Yeah, nobody has, because apparently it was not anything worth beans, but they used it as a scout plane.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who wrote it, just funnier than hell all the way through it. You know, he's talking about how slow it was, and he said one time they were flying along at full speed, and a seagull passed them up.
That's too funny.
Oh, that, yeah. And one time
talk about a sitting duck.
Over London, they were flying in a fog, and they didn't know what their altitude was. Their altimeter was out, so they dropped a lead line like on the old Mississippi River steamboats, and it happened to hit Nelson's statue in Trafalgar Square.
You're kidding.
Knocked out his other eye and scared the hell out of the pigeons. That whole story about the walrus, you can't just keep a straight face. It's funny. There's others about how Adolf Galland lost his brother, who was also a combat fighter pilot. He got shot down. And some of the other guys, Bobby Hartman, who was also a member of Shark Hunters, the most successful fighter pilot ever in history.
Eric Hartman?
Yeah, Eric
Hartman. Was a member of Shark Hunters. I want people to know that. And if you understand anything about World War II and fighter pilots, our aces had to score six kills to be five kills to be qualified as an ace. That's in the U.S. Army Air Force, where they were flying P-38s or P-47 Thunderbolts, whatever, it didn't matter.
P-40s, P-51s.
Yeah, they had to shoot down five, and they were an ace. Now, let me just give you an idea. In the German Luftwaffe, over 100 fighter pilots shot down 100 each minimum.
Oh, yeah.
100 each minimum. Now, these were supermen. I'm not saying that they were endemically better than anyone else, but they had to fight literally around the clock. There was no relief for them. They never flew. Some of them fell asleep sitting in the cockpit. They were that exhausted.
Right.
Now, Eric Hartman, just to give you an idea, didn't shoot down 5, didn't shoot down 10, not 30, not 50, not 75, not 100, not 150. How many did he shoot down, Harry?
352. The most successful fighter pilot ever in history, and because air combat has changed drastically, there will never be anybody come even close to that.
No.
And they had three guys... who shot down more than 300. Two. The other one was Barkhorn. He shot down 302. But Hartman was a member of Shark Hunters. I don't know what happened to Barkman. And the third most successful was Gunter Rall. He shot down 275 confirmed. 275.
They were very meticulous and strict about these kills, too. They could see a plane going down, but unless it was verified by somebody else, I guess they didn't get credit for it.
That is correct. And
Hartman's total could have been 400. We don't know.
Well, yeah, like I say, confirmed was 352. And
these are, folks, these are machine guns, right? With your finger on the button. These are not air-to-air missiles.
Oh, they had no missiles at that time.
No, of course not.
Machine guns or automatic cannons, 20-millimeter or 37-millimeter.
Yeah.
But no sidewinders.
He had to be absolutely brilliant. Brilliant at air strategy and tactician.
His theory of air combat was he never got involved in dogfights. He always got the upper hand. He got up into the sun.
Yeah.
He'd pick out his target, and he'd dive on it, and he waited till he was within less than 100 yards of his intended, and he'd... A couple hundred feet.
He'd shoot. Yeah. Sometimes the planes would just absolutely disintegrate on the spot, and pieces would hit his plane, and just incredible.
And some of them, I know Gunter Rall got shot down several times. Rudel, the greatest pilot of all time, he was not a fighter ace. He was the Stuka pilot. He got shot down, five times, and at least once, if not twice, I think, behind Russian lines. At one time, I know, he faked an injury,
mm-hmm.
and they had him in a Russian truck, and they were bringing him back to their camp, and he had a chance to jump off and run into the woods and made it back. He was also an ace toward the end during the defense of the Reich when all the bombers and dive bombers were parked and everybody got a fighter plane. He got a Focke Wulf FW-190. He still shot down 7 planes in the last couple months of the war.
Yeah. Well,
Stuka, he sank one battleship, mm-hmm. I think a cruiser, a bunch of other ships.
And how many tanks?
More than 500 Soviet tanks. And
hard to believe.
He helped refurbish the Argentine Air Force. He and Gunter Rall, I'm sorry, with Gallant, him and Gallant. And what the heck was it?
Kurt Tank went down there as well.
Yes, that's correct. He went down with about 50 other aeronautical engineers, and they designed fighter planes for the South American Air Forces, mostly the Argentine. I'm trying to remember the name of that bomber pilot that went down there. He was commander of Company Water.
Yeah, it'll come to you. It'll come to you.
Yeah. Well, right now, as you know, I'm fighting a cold. We in Florida, we get colds once a year. Last Tuesday was normal Florida day, 80 degrees. And then the cold front came through, and it went down to 23 degrees at night. And
wow.
Yeah, that always, that's our first cold snap of the year. I always wind up with a cold, so I probably sound like Froggy the Gremlin right now for you old people that remember Froggy.
No, you sound like Grammy the Froglin.
Yeah.
It's no problem. Now, today you were at something very interesting. This is a huge business around the world, believe it or not, and that is the business of World War II memorabilia, shall we call it. Military icons, military relics, military...
Militaria, right.
Yeah, it's formally called Militaria. But what is the show like this year?
Well, the show is tomorrow and Sunday at the Prine Osborne Convention Center in Jacksonville. This one's a fair size show. It's 500 tables, and
did you get a preview? Did you get a preview yet?
Well, yeah, we were there to set up, and the place is pretty huge.
Yeah,
it's a gun show and a militaria show combined.
Huh.
So we were at this show several years ago. We had tables there, but for the last few years we have not, for whatever reason. But we're there again now, and tomorrow and Sunday, it's open to the public, $8 a person to come in, and there's tons of things. We've got two tables full of artifacts and also our books.
Well, I hope you sell
fantastic covers.
Yeah, they really should draw a tremendous amount of addition. I hope you sell a lot of them. The issue of Militaria is one that we've touched on this before, but... There are people who literally, almost without pause, never stopped making certain things from the Third Reich because there's a demand for them. And there's an enormous number of hoaxed items out there, unfortunately.
Oh, there sure are.
I don't even know how to counsel people on finding something real for them. That's not easy to do in some cases. But there are a lot of good things out there. Because a lot of the World War II vets who brought things back are passing or did pass, and their surviving spouses, children, are not really knowing what to do with them, so they kind of let them go. That happens.
Yeah, that happens a lot. And a fellow who was a member of Shark Hunters, he was also my son's godfather. He used to go into North Florida and hang up wanted posters, wanted information on any downed airplanes, because we had more than 400 training bases in Florida during the war, and they were crashing planes all the time in the swamp. And
400 training bases?
Yeah.
We just overwhelmed Germany. Overwhelmed them.
Well, yeah.
Good Lord.
Nobody could keep up with the manufacturing capabilities of the U.S. in those days. And so he'd offer $500 to anybody who could show him where there was a downed airplane.
Uh-huh.
And he'd bring it back and renovate the thing and sell it for tons of money. And, excuse me.
It's all right.
But unfortunately, like you say, the dyes, the molds, for instance, for mm-hmm. the various metals were never destroyed. And so if people get a hold of those metals, those dyes,
yeah.
they use the same amalgams, and they cast genuine World War II medals that were made last week, and nobody can spot them.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there was one member of Shark Hunters we had to throw out with dishonorable discharge. He was member number 3, and we're up to 7,800 now.
Mm-hmm.
He was a crewman on U-505, and he was very believable. People would come to his booth at these military shows. Very engaging. He really was on all those combat tours. And they came to visit me in the early 90s, and like the part of Florida where I lived so much, they bought a house only about a half a mile from me, and I visited all the time. Excuse me. And one day
he was a legitimate U-boat survivor.
Oh, yeah. He was mm-hmm. on U-505, every mm-hmm. one of their combat patrols.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the guys that you see in the film when they're capturing the boat. So he really was on all those things. And so he and his girlfriend came to this country as tourists and then just never went home. He got a job as a machinist. His girlfriend, who later became his wife, they got a restaurant for her. They bought a house. It's not what you do on a vacation. And so INS raided the factory where he worked, and they found all these illegal Mexicans plus one illegal German. They didn't know what to do with him. So at that time, he was a decent guy. So I got letters from a lot of our important members, and I sent them all to Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, who was a member of Shark Hunters, and said, mm-hmm. hey, let's help this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they did. They gave him an exception till he got his citizenship, or at least a green card. And then I went over to visit him at his house after they moved by us. And I walked in the front door, and there's a big carton full of U-boat combat badges, U-boats-Kriegsabzeichen. And they were reproductions. So, I asked him, I said, what the hell's all this? He says, well, I won the Oberskriegsabzeichen. I said, yeah, you won one of them. You got about 300 here, and these are all reproductions. Well, when you get the award, you can buy others to put on your uniform. I said, yeah, but you don't have a uniform, and these are all fakes. So he was taking them to gun shows. They were costing him about $30-$35 a piece at the time.
Yeah.
And he was selling them at military shows, gun shows. Ja, das war mein Kriegsabzeichen. And he was getting $300, $400 for them. Bad enough he was cheating people out of money. He was cheating people out of honest history. So as soon as we found out...
Yeah, that's disgraceful.
Yes, it is. And I put it before my advisory board. And at that time, Otto Kretschmer was one of the guys on the board.
U-boat skipper.
And I still remember the letter. He said, in the letter, he said, "Take no half measures, Harry. Put him out immediately." So we put him out dishonorably.
And, wow. See, that was there's another example of World War II German military code of honor behavior. No question. They just didn't play games.
No, for the most part, he's the only dishonorable one
that you've probably ever run into.
That's right. All the rest of them, they're just fanatically honorable. And this guy was doing fine, too. Well, I met him first in 1982, and he met this little French dolly who was about half his age, and he left his wife of many decades, walked out on her and his children with her, take up with this other person, and she's the one who everything she saw had dollar signs. So it got him to where he just abandoned his morality.
Yeah,
but for the most part, though, you find guys who, you know, there was a guy named Bruno who was a survivor of the Bismarck. He was an honorable man. At another military show I was at a few years ago, they had, what the hell was his name, Walter Schunk. He had shot down 200 airplanes, and they also had the U.S. Army Air Force pilot that shot him down. Signing autographs. Now, this was an honorable man. And that was an interesting battle, too, because Walter Schunk had shot down 200 in combat, and this rookie lieutenant comes up, and somehow it got favorable, and he shot down Schunk, and within minutes, he got shot down himself. So yesterday's enemies are today's friends. They were sitting together signing autographs at a different military show.
We also want to point out that that pilots who bailed out were not under orders, German orders, to be shot in their parachutes. That was absolutely not true.
That's an interesting situation. You know, they talk about how, for instance, well, the story was, of course, that the German U-boaters always machine gun people in the water, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
But, of course, the U.S. Navy guys, they did quite a bit. And when Mush Morton, commanding USS Wahoo, sank a Japanese troop transport in broad daylight, he looked through the scope, and in his logbook he put that he saw about 10,000 Imperial Marines bobbing around in their life jackets. And he surfaced the submarine and spent the next hour killing everybody in the water. So we got to looking into this, and there is a treaty. I forget the name of the treaty. It was done either during World War I or just after. It may sound barbaric, and it probably is barbaric, but if...
Harry, hold that thought. We have to take a
hold
break.
Hold that thought.
Yeah, that's a good place to pause. We'll come back, finish that story, and then bring David Dees on here. We're going to go through the books, and do bring them up. They're right there in guests under Harry Cooper's name.
Yeah, so they look fantastic.
Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, and we are back. All right, Mr. Cooper, let's finish that story. A treaty of some kind.
Yeah, it like I said, it might not be moral, and it might not be very nice. But the way the way this treaty reads, if you're in a ship and you sink another ship, if he's within his own territorial waters or his own controlled waters, like when Wahoo sank this transport, they were sunk in Japanese-controlled waters. They would have been picked up by Japanese ships and used against American Marines. So at that point, it's fair, according to this treaty, to kill the people in the water. Likewise, fighter pilots, for instance, we'll say over Germany, if a German shoots down an American plane and the guy gets out in his parachute, hits the silk, the treaty says leave him go because the people on the ground are going to catch him and put him in the POW camp. But if the American shoots down a German over Germany, it's okay to gun him in his chute because once he gets to the ground, he's going to get another airplane and come back at you. And a perfect example was Günter Rohl, as I was going to say, the third most successful fighter pilot.
Uh-huh.
I visited with him in his home in Bad Reichenhall in southern Bavaria. Funny guy, spoke perfect English. And he was showing me his hand that was missing a thumb. And he said, Hub Zemke and his people shot off my thumb and they saved my life. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I was diving on two of his Thunderbolts and shooting them down, and two more Thunderbolts were diving on me, and my airplane was on fire, and a bullet came, and it shot off my thumb, and they saved my life. I says, General, what the hell are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. And with a little twinkle in his eye, he said, I bailed out of my airplane, and when I got to the ground, if I still had my thumb, the Luftwaffe would say, take another airplane, go up and die. So according to this treaty, if you incapacitate the enemy combatant, if he's in his own backyard, you can go ahead and kill him because he's just going to get another plane, ship, whatever, and come after you. But if you shoot him down over your territory, his enemy territory, don't worry about him because the people on the ground are going to catch him and put him in a POW camp. Likewise, if an enemy soldier throws down his rifle and walks towards you with his hands in the air, take him prisoner. But if he turns around and runs the other way, it's okay to shoot him in the back because he's just going for another weapon. That's the way the treaty reads. It doesn't seem very nice, but then again, war ain't very nice.
Now, is that an actual exact approximate number, 10,000 Japanese troops on one ship?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They had big ships. When our troops, our American troops were transiting with the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth, I think they had way more than that. I think so. But anyhow, Mush Morton put down that one of the 20 millimeters, the gun tube jammed, and so they had to replace the gun tube and, quote, continue strafing survivors, unquote. They were even using his .45 sidearm. They were using the 5-inch deck gun. And, you know, you can see his point.
Well, the water must have been red.
It must have been, yeah. The sharks must have had a great time. Yeah. And I talked to another American submarine officer, and he said, if we sank a ship, Japanese ship, out in the middle of Mother Ocean, it was easy to be gallant and let them go because you know they were going to die anyhow. But if you sank the ship in Japanese water, he said, we made sure nobody in the other uniform was still alive. Another one of our members who was a PT boat crewman, he said that after a while, the PT boats were turned into gun platforms. And he said when an American sub would sink a Japanese ship in Japanese water, the PT boats were called on to go out and kill them all.
Okay. Let's go and take a look at the books because they do capture some of what we're talking about. In fact, a lot of it.
Boy, I'll tell you.
Yeah. David, are you there?
I am here.
How are you?
I'm good. Hello, Harry.
Hey, David. Nice to talk to you finally. We've been doing all our conversation through the email.
That's true. Yeah, we just did, we've done 7 covers now, and you were asking at the beginning of the show, you were talking about my inspiration for them. I can give you that if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
Okay,
David.
Actually, you've done 9 covers for us when you count Hitler in Argentina and also Hitler in the Secret Alliance.
Yeah.
That's right. He sent me the PDFs, and I began reading these. And the interesting thing about Harry's books are that they're not really political. They mostly are written from, like diaries almost, from the person who experienced them. And any subject that I start to illustrate, I always want to know what I'm looking at. I have to understand it, you know, from many different angles so I can get an idea of how to bring a visual that the person, the viewer, will understand the feeling of it. And so when I started reading about the U-boat, the first ones I did was the U-boat, I didn't understand this is not a normal submarine as we think about a submarine in America. These submarines that the Germans built, which literally ruled the Atlantic. They really took over that whole section of the planet because they were so crafty. These boats, they called them U-boats, but they were submarines, but the top of them was flat and had a surface where they could come out the top, and the whole crew could come out if it was a nice day and out on the ocean, and they could go swimming, and they could walk around and enjoy themselves up in the sunshine. So they weren't stuck inside the submarines the whole time. And sometimes they got surprised by enemy aircraft when they would be up there enjoying themselves, and then suddenly, you know, they would be. That's how they could sink them. They could surprise them that way.
So
I started looking at documentary films that the Germans had made about the inside of the submarines, these U-boats, and the inside. It was about the size of a fuselage of maybe a Delta airliner. But you also had the engine in there with you, and all the machinery was inside there. So there was a very narrow area where they had to operate, and they would put something like 40 men in there. And the men were so young. You know, you think about men, but these were children. They were 17 years old, 18 years old maybe, and the skipper was 25. So it was... It was a harrowing thing they were doing, and I don't know what the percentage of these men that went out made it.
Well,
back.
It's a horrific percentage. David, did you see the movie Das Boot? Boat. Some people say boot, but it is boat. We always want to make that clear. Das Boot.
That's correct. Das Boot. That's German.
Did you see that movie?
I started watching that for reference because I went through a lot of documentaries.
It's staggeringly real.
Fantastic movie.
I lived in
one man out of David.
Ago.
David, one man out of seven came home.
That's it.
One man out of seven.
Right.
Well, once they came ashore, you know, once they came to dock, they turned around and went right back out. That's probably why there were so many losses. These guys were, what people don't realize, and I apologize to anybody listening that fought in World War II and was told all these years that this was the good war. This was anything but a good war. My experience of learning about the real history behind World War II was the Germans were really defending Germany. If you know about World War I, how they redrew the borders of Germany and included parts of Poland and into France, and the Bolsheviks in Poland were massacring Germans. That's why Hitler had to go into Poland.
Exactly.
He was not going to take over the world like the Zionist media wants you to believe. This was not the case. And why would, you know, how else could you motivate all these young German men to fight so gallantly? They were really defending Germany, and when they were beating France and England so easily, you know, the Zionists had to bring in America to really,
turn the tables,
roll over
right.
them. Please.
Yeah, hold on, David. No, I know. Hold on a minute. We have to pause for a little break. We'll come right back with David Dees and Harry Cooper and yours truly. Okay, and we're back. Harry Cooper and I are here with you, and Harry's with us once a month for 2 hours on Friday, the third Friday of each month. He is in Florida right now. I am on the other side of the country, as is David Dees. David's been talking about his feelings as someone who got involved with this project of creating brand new art covers for some of the most important books ever assembled about World War II, and that's no exaggeration. And he has been talking about his feelings about the war and when he researches it and the things that come to him emotionally, intellectually, mentally, and he has stated it exactly correctly. Harry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the front covers of these books, several of them depict guys who were members of Shark Hunters, and I'll give you a couple little insights into each of them. Now,
let's start at the top, and
okay.
We're going to go right through. You can't see, but I have them
also,
on a page. Go ahead, David.
Can you direct them to the link so we can?
I've been mentioning it. It's right in the guests section under Harry Cooper's name.
Right.
You'll see it. Just go there. Take a
and
look.
And your listeners can also go to sharkhunters.com, and yep. they can buy these books.
Oh, and if you want to, you want a stocking stuffer for someone who cares about history, you could not do better. What a treat. Get a couple of three of these books and just stick them in the stocking. And
the nice
watch,
thing about it, Jeff, yeah. I met most of these guys. I knew most of these guys.
Yeah.
They were all friends.
Yes.
And for instance, on volume two, the front cover, that's Eric Topp at the Periscope, the third most successful submarine commander.
Yeah. Well,
World War II.
Yeah, let's get to that in a minute. Let me okay. hold on, please. Click on Books by Harry Cooper under Harry's name. It says Harry Cooper, World War II Books by Harry Cooper, and click on Books by Harry Cooper, and you'll bring up the page. And well, let's start, first of all, with Hitler in Argentina, which was
okay.
David's first book for you.
Right.
And that has taken a story that you broke literally to the world first
yeah.
by
yeah.
decades and has
yep.
been ridiculously pilfered and looted by con artist after con artist. But it
yeah.
was Harry Cooper who put this data together from people who were there. There was one
yeah.
man who contributed largely to the book who was in the bunker. All right? This is no
yeah,
joke.
Don Angel.
This is no
yeah,
joke.
That was, right. Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco, he was a Spaniard who worked for the Third Reich. And in the final couple of months of the war, his post was in the Führer bunker. And one of his duties was to make a report to Hitler himself every day about some phase of the war. And then he personally saw Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, who was by then Eva Hitler, saw them forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann and removed from the Führer bunker and taken to South America.
They were carried out on stretchers, correct?
Well, carried out. No, people propping them up.
Uh-huh.
When Eva left, she was walking, barely dragging her feet, shuffling, and she was propped up by two other girls. And one of our researchers, Michael Ivanheim, who wrote the second book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance, he thinks he's pretty well identified these two women as a pair of dykes, as as
uh-huh.
he puts it, and
uh-huh.
That they popped up in South America also. But unlike some of these people who have lifted my work and also lifted the work of Ebel Basti down in Argentina, I go to Germany every year, sometimes as many as five times a year, to visit with these veterans and do my research. I just got back a couple of months ago from Bavaria and Austria. I've been in Argentina four times, twice to Hitler's estate, which you see on the front cover of the book. That's a picture I took of Hitler's estate. Interesting thing, another one of my people, we call him or her Pizarro found that from 23rd of April onward, Adolf Hitler did not sign any orders. All the orders from 23rd April onward were signed by Martin Bormann.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're pretty confident that Hitler was taken out on the 23rd when it was still possible to get in and out through one corridor in Berlin. The Red Army hadn't closed the ring yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if Hitler was there, why wasn't he signing the orders? And, of course, Stalin, in July of 1945, 3 months after the alleged suicide, he was screaming publicly that the United States and England were not doing enough to find Hitler. Well, if Hitler's dead and you got his body, why do you want people to look for him?
Of course.
Stalin knew he was gone, and,
yeah.
and in that book, Hitler in Argentina, we published comments from many of the world leaders at the time. Truman asked Stalin.
Fascinating.
Stalin told him he's not dead.
That's right.
And various other leaders.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover found out in a back doorway that Hitler was not dead and he should stop looking for him. It's kind
right.
of a funny
and,
story in itself.
One of our guys, one of our agents, a person we call Taucher, which means diver, this person spent several weeks in the National Archives about 6 or 7 years ago finding dust-covered boxes that the archivists didn't even know they had, finding all these secret FBI files in there, which he got declassified, and we've got copies of it. Dozens and dozens of FBI and CIA documents stating they knew Hitler got away. They knew Hitler was in Argentina. This was in 1945, 1946. So all our spook agencies knew it. Our government knew it. The Soviet government knew it.
And the reason, ladies and gentlemen, technology. The big trade was Hitler and the escape route for many, many, many members of the German government. Industrial class, tens of thousands perhaps, made it to Argentina in exchange for people like Wernher von Braun and others who were ultimately to take us to the moon. It was all about technology. If you look at the front cover of the book that David did, it's brilliant. We suspect that that aircraft is the one that flew Hitler and Eva to Argentina. We also look at the back of the cover. And if you look at many pictures of Hitler, you can tell that is him. That is a photograph of him shortly before he died. Look at the nose. Look at the nostrils. Hitler's left nostril, our right, was lower than his right nostril, which we see on the left. Take a look at it when he was a very young man in the 30s and then a very old man in the early 1960s. And you'll see a nose that has gotten puffier as noses do, but it's the same nostril configuration, the same mouth, it's the same face. They may have put a dimple in his chin through cosmetic surgery down there. That's unclear, but it's obviously Hitler. Look at the ears. The ears grow as you get older, too, but it's the same ear. It's obviously him. There is really no question about this, none. David, when you got this first inkling that I told you there was a possibility of doing this book, what went through your head? What did you think about this?
The cover of Hitler in Argentina?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What went through my head? Well, I was very honored to be doing this bit of history. Harry has done what few people have ever done, is he's assembled history, real history. He's gone and interviewed these people, the eyewitnesses. He's traveled all over South America. He went to the place where the house where Hitler was living and interviewed, you know, the waitress that waited on him and Eva Braun at the restaurant there in that town. And, you know,
1949.
Yeah,
supposedly.
In addition to that, he was taken out to that house built by the Mercedes family on a boat skippered by a man who grew up on the estate when Hitler and Eva were living there as a boy for years. And we're hopeful that Harry will be able to connect with him. He's still alive, and he has a story to tell.
We finally found out his name. We got his name now.
All right. Well, we'll get
him. I will say that the honor was in, you know, I like most people that are listening, I grew up with World War II movies and was indoctrinated on the fact that Hitler was the most evil person on the planet. But now, with the research I've done and a lot of people, the conclusion a lot of people came to was we realized that the media has painted him to be that way, and he was actually one of the greatest leaders this planet has ever known. And my respect for this man is so astronomical. I can gladly tell you that. And anyone that would research the man and the path that Germany had to go through to just exist, and then to turn it around and become one of the most powerful on the planet.
They were punished after World War I, David, more severely than any country I have ever come across in my studies of history.
Yeah, and that's why I put him on the cover of the first U-boat. I understood that there was a story where Hitler came on to the onto one of the U-boats, and they painted this whole image of him and the people around him, and I just had to include him on the cover of the first one. There's five on the U-boat series, and each one is packed. I think it's got, I don't know, maybe about 12 to 15 or 20 chapters, and each one is written by a different person from their viewpoint of the war. It's amazing. Yeah. I often don't read these books that I illustrate, but I got very sucked into this one. This was wonderful.
Yeah, once you get into it, you can't put them down. And as David said, there's 5 books in the U-Boat series so far. Keep your pen and ink handy, David. There's a bunch more coming down the road within the next 6 months.
All right. Well, great.
Because all these stories have been in our monthly magazine over the years, and thank God I've got them all onto computer, so we just, you know, copy and paste. So we're going to start putting out probably 4 more in 2015, if not more than that, plus a few more Flyboy books, When Eagles Soared.
Great. All right. Wonderful. Very good. Stand by. We have to take a break. We'll come right back in about 6-7 minutes. Hold on.